Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is the navigator of the GNE, John Lash, and I'm recording in the late hours of October 29th, 2012, from Andalusia. This is Nav Briefing 33. I'm giving it the title, Focusing the GNE. I'm sure that title will be come as a welcome relief already to a good many of you on the crew. So my intention in this talk, which follows up the last one about 3 weeks ago, I guess, maybe two and a half. Sometimes I lose track of the illusion of time. My intention is to do just that, to recall the premises of the Gaia Navigation Experiment for you, and to restate the objectives of that experiment with an emphasis on the immediate objectives, the objectives ahead in the next 2.5 months during the stall of the lunar apogee at the Eye of the Bull. And finally, to perhaps offer some clues or, I don't like to use the word suggestion because it reeks of mind control, clues and indications brewing in my mind regarding what we could designate as the result of our experiment. After all, one performs an experiment hoping to achieve certain results. So in this talk, I'm going to concentrate on the stated objectives, the immediate challenges ahead, that is to say, the course I'm plotting for the next 2.5 months, and the proposed or possible or imaginable results of this unique and exciting experiment. Looking at gaiaspore.org, I see that NB32, entitled rather awkwardly, Cooperating Freedom, was posted on the 10th of October. So here we are, 19 days later. A couple of brief comments regarding that talk. First of all, I may have not been as clear as I would like to be in that talk. I actually got off on a riff, which then bled over into another talk entitled, Consent and Command, and wasn't able to successfully complete that, so I didn't post it. The subject of command, however, is absolutely essential to the success of this experiment, and I may have spoken of passage of command and matters of that sort in this previous NAB briefing. I'll take another pass at it as soon as I can, as I would very much like to clarify these notions. These are really what I call ethical notions that are at the core of the newly emergent genre of Gaian ethics, that is to say, ethics with teeth. And these core concepts are, for instance, sovereignty, or svatantriya in Sanskrit, and also the notion of command, and by contrast, the notion of consent and the importance of consent. What is consent, and what is the ultimate trick of the globalist psychopaths? Well, those are almost the same question. We often hear now that the game is rigged. You know, the financial game, the financial markets are rigged, the elections are rigged, the justice system is rigged. You can believe that. I've been in it. Don't you ever get near it expecting that you'll have any justice or that truth has any clout in that system. Education is rigged, entertainment is rigged, and so on and so forth. You might recall, those of you who read metahistory.org, that a couple of years ago or more, I published a little piece on that site called Karma is a Rigged Game. It's crucial that I continue in the vein of NB32 at some point, but in a more lucid manner, I would hope, because this is the moment when I would very much like to explain how the game is rigged at the most essential level, and that concerns the problem of consent. And I truly believe that if the average intelligent person understands how the psychopaths trick us with this issue of consent, then a great deal of things would unwind in this world very rapidly. So this is an important talk. I'm swing around to it someday soon. The other point I want to make regarding NB32 is the lapse of time of 19 days. Just after I recorded NB32 on the 10th of October, my books and library and archive collection arrived at Ambergane House. That was 12 days after the beginning of the first year of Ambergane. So I have been, to some extent, kind of preoccupied and, to use an old hackneyed word, overwhelmed by what is in this library. And so I have these lapses, as you know. Those of you who follow this experiment closely know that I appear to drop away at times. I never do, in fact, drop away from the experiment or from the navigational tasks, never do. But at times, I find that I stand before an immensity that sort of intimidates me, you could say, and renders me silent. So I don't like to have these lapses, but nonetheless, there is continuity. And I know those of you who are trusting of this experiment stay in that continuity with me, regardless of the irregularity of my briefings and so forth. So with that said, I'll launch into the current topic, focusing the GNE. And I want to say right now at 8 minutes and 10 seconds that I actually don't know what I'm going to say in the course of this talk. And as I start talking to you right now, I don't know how to focus the GNE. And I don't know what the ultimate result we are seeking could be. So just stay tuned and we'll see what I have to say by the end of this talk. To get started, it might be helpful if I reiterate the initial conditions of the GNE. This I can do, I would say, in fairly brief and cogent terms. In the first place, I proposed this experiment on the basis of my own realizations of March 2011. The invitation to the experiment went out in June, and so from March 19th through April and May into June, I was reflecting on what happened on March 19th, and thus I was formulating the initial conditions of my proposal to join the GNE. And you will recall that I stated 3 events that had occurred, 1 event that had occurred, and 2 subsequent events that would then be in development. The event that occurred was that at the time of the supermoon of March 19th, 2011, about 7 days after the Fukushima disaster, the planet Earth sent out a signal to the galactic center. I compared it to the massive bullhorn of an ocean liner. You know that deep, rolling, smooth rolling sound made by the horn of a great, great ocean liner. And it was some kind of acoustic signal, yet it was able to operate at a very high, high velocity, exceeding the velocity of the speed of sound, which is 768 miles an hour, or 728, I can't ever remember. And I stated at that time that due to this event, I had inferred, on the basis of my knowledge of the sacred narrative of the mysteries, that the moment of correction had arrived. So I drew my claim, if you will, I based my claim upon the ancient received material from the mysteries. The myth of the Aeon Sophia is open-ended, and it leaves us, or left us, in the condition that the Gnostics left it. It left us with a riddle and a massive cosmic event to be anticipated, which is called the correction or diorthosis of the Aeon Sophia. When I, all through my life, as I investigated and developed that mystery material, and as I meticulously restored the narrative into a coherent plot of 9 parts, I never expected that I would be living during the correction of the Divine Sophia. But in March of 2011, as far as I can tell, on the best of my knowledge and scholarship and my training in experimental mysticism and telestic shamanism, I confirm that it did begin. And by looking at the celestial conditions at that time, I also indicated that the time Sophia would take to establish the initial conditions of correction was 10 seconds of her time, or 3 years of human time. And therefore correction, the initial conditions of correction, would be completed by March 2014. And from then on, for the remaining 200 or so years, 202 years of this Kalpa, correction would proceed. Now, one of the objectives of this experiment is to learn what correction is and to participate in the correction process, as there is no pre-formulated designation of what it is. The only thing that comes close to an indication of what correction might be was the line I have often quoted, in which Sophia herself declares that when the Archons reach the consummation of their power, which is absurdity and senseless violence, then they would be defeated by that luminous child. And so there's good reason to link together that declaration of the planetary animal mother itself with the moment of correction. It doesn't describe what she does in correction, but it certainly has something to say about our participation. So the initial objective of this experiment was to see if we could follow this process of correction, to see if I, for one, as the self-designated navigator, could chart it, and that you could make sense of my charting process and take on this realization of this unique moment in the life of our species and bring it into your own experience. So this is not an ordinary learning process here. This is a process about learning to experience the supernatural power of the earth itself. And that, of course, could have many ramifications. Now, in that sense, defining the goal of our experience, of our experiment, as learning to participate in the supernatural power of the earth, that parameter accords, of course, very well with the concept of planetary tantra, which I have defined as interactive magic with Gaia. And so, of course, we know that the Gaian navigation experiment is a special case, a special project within the overall frame of planetary tantra. So in addition to that proposal, I also indicated at the time that the experiment got going that we would be participants on the journey of the Earth as it undertakes a massive shift, a massive dynamical shift. And I defined that in physical terms and in astronomical terms, because, to the best of my knowledge, this is really, actually, physically, and astronomically what is happening with the Earth since March of 2011. I think that it started to happen sometime before that, probably. There were probably tremors and precursors, like the temblors, or that precede an earthquake. But the planetary animal mother, the Aeon Sophia, who is the living consciousness and intelligence of this planet, launched directly into total involvement in correction in March of 2012. Speaking astronomically, this means that from this moment on, the Earth begins to assume A, its own self-navigation in the vast space of the interstellar reaches of the galactic arm, and B, it assumes its own powers of propulsion. Now, using the nautical metaphor, I also indicated at that time that its powers of propulsion are steam and sail. Steam being the telluric activity, telluric and volcanic activity of the material body of the planet, which has certainly been superactive over the last year and a half and continues to be. And sail being the equally active area of the atmosphere, the lower atmosphere, the livable atmosphere, the troposphere, all the way out to the ionosphere. So you can say that the atmosphere is her sails, and the telluric earth energies are her steam engines. And these are operating now in a way that has not been the case before. So finally, I suggested that due to correction and due to this mass shift in the physical and astronomical status of this planet, that the Aeon Sophia can achieve release from the capture of the planetary system. So imagine the planetary system, which is the Sun, Mercury, and Venus between the Sun and the Earth, then the Earth with its satellite, the Moon, and beyond the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Imagine those bodies in the archontic planetary system being separated into two parts. The three-body system of Gaia's own dynamical world, which is Earth, Sun, and Moon, and then the remaining five planets. And so the Earth, Sun, Moon system has the capacity, in Sophia's correction, to take on an entirely different course and to move in an entirely different manner. The Sun, of course, is not a planet. It's a star that defines the central vortex of the planetary system. And it might be more correct to think of the Sun as a plasma vortex than even an actual body. The planets in the fleet of the solar system do move, or they appear to move, in a regular manner in the circular ripples that are thrown out by the plasma vortex of the sun. This is one way to imagine the solar system, consistent with the emergent science of plasma cosmology and the electric universe, I might add. So, as I indicated at the beginning of the experiment, all this being so, and bearing in mind that we are looking at astronomical and astrophysical and telluric events of an unusual and momentous nature, that we could expect to see a lot of anomalies in the natural processes of this planet. And so I asked you at the beginning of this experiment if you would observe those anomalies and report them to me. And I invited you to be on the navigation deck, looking over my shoulder as I navigate, learning how to use the navigational tools, and all the while using your powers of observation. That was a simple and fairly innocent invitation, I would say. Very rapidly, this experiment expanded into something really immense. It grew very large, very fast. The immense implications of it became evident. And now, a year and a half later, we are looking at a vastly expanded scenario compared to my humble proposition back in June of 2011. So, Mimetis, it's only natural, considering the way this experiment has expanded, and in both in scope and in the richness of its content, and then the richness of the discoveries and realizations it offers, it's only natural that we on board are time to time going to get lost, going to become disoriented, or going to lose track of what's ahead because we are observing a rich array of themes and elements that have now emerged in the course of the experiment. And I myself lose track, or I would say I don't exactly lose track, but I become at times uncertain of where the priorities and emphases might be placed as the experiment reveals its different facets day by day, night by night, and month by month. So one thing you might have noticed is we have followed the apogee surges, the apogee moments, very carefully. I've plotted them very carefully and continue to do so. I have not been able to give language or syntax, and in some cases not even been able to give clues to some of the perigee moments, although I have given them my best shot. In fact, it is really impossible for anyone, including myself, to keep up and running with all the emergent dimensions of this experiment. So it is important that we chronicle this, because even though the 10 seconds of Sophia's time are going very fast, in the future, the ship's log will not only be a record of our observations, but it will also be the basis for stimulating deep realizations of how correction was established, regarding how correction was established and regarding how correction is proceeding. Because, bear in mind, correction proceeds for 202 years after the initial conditions are set. Okay, so what's next? Where to look next? You know, if you could look at my desk or the room, I should take a picture of it. You know, the three rooms in my house dedicated to charting the navigational process. If you could look at that, you'd see that There's a lot going on here. And as the experiment proceeds into the second half now, there is more and more of a risk of losing sight of our objectives and becoming unfocused and overwhelmed. So again, the purpose of this talk is to focus the GNE. And the question is, how am I going to do that? I don't know exactly how to do that. I don't have a pre-formulated answer, but I might arrive at something you can bite your teeth into by the time this talk is concluded. I better get going because we're at 25 minutes here already. So, okay, here I go. Let's see if I can take a pass at this. The primary objective of the Gaia Navigation Experiment in which you are now engaged is to bring you into an actual realization of the power of divine imagination whose source is the earth. Now, we know, following the Gnostic narrative, or the telestic narrative, more properly speaking, of the mysteries, that the source of the earth is in the pleromic matrix, or the center of our local galaxy. And I mean that physically. This is no metaphor. This is not just a symbolic indication. That is literally the case. And so, due to the Aeon Sophia having morphed into this planet, which was not an anticipated feature of her experiment for the Antipos, due to that anomaly, according to the Gospel of Philip, quote, the world as it actually is came about through a mistake, end quote. Due to that, the power of the pleromic aeons is present in the material body of the earth and the atmosphere of the earth. As you know from reading Not in His Image, that the Aeon Sophia has two forms. One is her planetary body, which is the earth itself and all that lives within the livable atmosphere of the earth is part of her body, part of her cellular existence, which also extends into the electromagnetic aura and the aura and the atmospheric field of the earth, the bima. Secondly, she retains always her primary substance body, which is the organic light that fills the pleroma, that fills the galactic center. And here it is. We are in it, swimming in it, immersed in it. And the organic light, as I said, wells up out of material mass. And what you see as materiality around you, take a look, scan your eyes over it. All that you see, the human-made and the nature-made alike, including your own body, is floating in the organic light of the planetary animal mother. Her primary substance body is a luminosity, a living luminosity, a living animating luminosity of infinite density and zero mass. Now, the objective of this experiment is for you to come to realize through this story, through the narrative, and through the observations over this 3-year period of time, how your genius as a magical animal of the goddess, how your genius potential is nested and nurtured in her pleromic light force, life force. That is the source. You know, the only spirituality worth pursuing is spirituality that takes you to the source of life and the source of your own life, which is the source of your mind, the source of your feelings. And as I've said before, that source is immanent. All religions are erroneous in that they disregard divine immanence. Of course, that's not true of Hindu religion. In certain aspects, it does point to divine immanence, and so do certain more arcane teachings of Buddhism, especially Tibetan or Tantric Buddhism. But generally speaking, the failure of religion and all forms of spirituality on this planet, past, present, and future, has been in the disregard of what is divine immanence. Divine immanence means that this world was not created as an artifact and then left to stand there like the pot created by a potter stands on the shelf. Divine immanence means that this world, this material world, is imminently, perpetually, and immediately sustained at every instant by the dreaming power that brought it forth. So as I stand here and talk to you, I'm not just a human animal living off some store of life force that I acquired when I was born. I am actually sustained and kept alive by the greater immanent life force of the planetary animal mother. Just like the cells in your body, which produce the energy and reproduce the energy through ATP and the ribosomes that vitalizes your body, those cells are sustained by the immanent presence that you are. And when that immanent presence is called into another metamorphosis, those cells cannot live anymore in that beautiful structural configuration, you know, as your body. So, divine immanence is one of our themes. Divine immanence is what we contemplate continuously. The Gaian navigation experiment is a plunge into the reality of divine immanence. But to put it in more plain and simple terms, I'm sorry I can't reduce it to monosyllabics as I would do if I was a good Maine boy. To put it as simply as possible, I would say that the dreaming power of the Aeon Sophia is what you achieve by this experiment. You achieve access to that dreaming power, and through access, you achieve the dreaming power itself. Now, in this respect, I would venture to say that we living in the moment of Sophia's correction have an advantage that even the Telestai did not have. They were able to access the organic light, and they were able to learn at a genius level through divine mathesis, or theoria, which is to say the beholding of the organic light. Theoria means beholding, and learning from that light. Mathesis means learning. We can do even more. We can not only be interactive with the planetary animal mother in ways that they were not, but if this experiment succeeds, then each and every member will have arrived at an integrated access to the dreaming power of the Earth. Integrated access. And this dreaming power of the Earth, of which you find some hints in the great fables of Carlos Castaneda, this dreaming power of the Earth is represented by the eye of the bull. And I've used the language, the directive power of divine imagination. Divine imagination, that is to say, the dreaming power of the earth, is not human imagination, but it is accessible to human animals. And so, whereas we seek to understand our own capacities for imagination through the endowment of the luminous epinoia and the pretending power of the perinoia, we also endeavor to understand that the divine Sophia has her own dreaming power of imagination that surpasses and transcends those human faculties. I need to specify as best I can in the next 2.5 months what is the difference between the dreaming power of the goddess, her power of emanation by which she emanates all material and vital processes on the planet. Sanskrit term for that being Maya Shakti. While I endeavor to deepen and focus our understanding of that power of hers and what she intends to achieve with it, I need also to distinguish the functions of our powers of epinoia and perinoia, as they are distinct from that, but at the same time as they interface with that. So that is the main objective, and that is, as I've said before, the emphasis in the second half of this experiment. You can say that the focusing of the GNE is a group exercise of focusing on the eye of the bull. And one part of that focusing process involves working channel 16. Where does Jupiter stand from now until April 2013? Uniquely positioned in a line between the eye of the bull, Aldebaran, and the star Elnath, marking the north, the tip of the north horn of the bull. And that, as you know, is the crossbeam of the celestial anchor, and it also may be conceived as the crossbeam of the whip antenna of Pleromic Relay, which has its tip in the Pleiades and its root in the star Procyon. So when I propose that the objective of this experiment is integral engagement with the dreaming power of the earth, I am not proposing it as a metaphysical proposition. I am not putting it in metaphysical terms at all, am I? There's nothing metaphysical about what I'm saying. It is imaginative and astronomical at the same time, and you can even go out and observe the factors, the actual real-time celestial factors that reflect to you the experiment you are undertaking. Now, you show me one other game going on this planet that comes anywhere close to that. You know, I've said in the introduction to Planetary Tantra on MetaHistory.org that although Planetary Tantra is a novel and original event, it's a novel and original opportunity that could only arise in the closing moments of Kali Yuga, it does have a certain precedent in Asian mysticism. And that precedent is called Shaktism, from the word Shakti, meaning sacred power. And Shaktism is therefore the worship of that sacred power, to use the unfortunate word. Of course, it's not the worship of anything. It is the recognition and command of sacred power. So in this experiment, you, along with myself, are continually living with the question, the rumination and the meditation, if you will, what is sacred power? And what I'm telling you is that sacred power is the dreaming emanation power called Maya Shakti. This is sacred power. It is the source of everything in the material world. And there is nothing, by the way, that is not material in regard to the productions of that power. Maya Shakti is the materializing power of the primordial ground awareness, which is often called Shiva and may be called Parasamvit, if you like the sound of that word. So, recognizing and engaging this sacred power is what our experiment is about, isn't it? And I want to say to you now something that I haven't said previously, and here it comes. I guess I can pull this off. In the course of the experiment, as you come to recognize and integrate sacred power, understood as the dreaming emanation of the earth, you also come to realize what evil is. Now, we spent a great deal of time at the beginning, in the first half of this experiment, considering the riddle of evil, didn't we? And as a tool for that deep and daunting exercise, which Nietzsche called staring into the abyss without becoming the abyss, in the course of that exercise, I provided two tools, the imaginative tool of the satanic mask of Cetus and the actual observational tool of the pentagramic star formation at the head of the constellation of Cetus. Now, if you've been following this experiment, even in a half-rigorous manner, I think you might have to admit in yourself that the combination of these tools of observation and imagination is pretty damn powerful. And we learned many things from this exercise. Now, in the second half of the experiment, I want to focus the GNE on the objective, which I will call not just facing the orchestrations of social evil, but seeing to the root of evil. You see, it's only possible to see to the root of evil when you have intimate interaction with that dreaming power, that sacred power. That is not to say that evil, which is defined by me, by the way, as destructive human behavior, not as any metaphysical agency in the universe, not as some satanic or luciferic entity, but simply as the as a human, as something that humans do. Excuse me. Evil is something that humans do. What we want to understand in the second part of this experiment, one of the objectives now, is how they do that evil and why and where does it come from. And what I'm saying to you is that it does not come out of sacred power. It comes out of repulsion to sacred power. And those human animals who are afraid of sacred power, unable to surrender themselves to that awesome and intimate contact with her, with the mother herself, develop a reactive projection syndrome. This reaction projection syndrome turns human will and feeling into a toxic pathology that leads to behavior of evil. And that behavior of evil, because it is not natural to the human animal, because it is unnatural to be repelled by contact with the mother and with her awesome beauty and power. It is an unnatural response in the human animal. That pathology must be sustained by elaborate means. And those elaborate means are seen in the ideologies of religious damnation and retribution and salvation. Religious damnation and retribution and salvation, and the deeply schizophrenic religious ideology of the master race, which originated with the Zadokim cult of the ancient Hebrews, are the factors that must be maintained in order for human beings to maintain their sick, evil, perverted, destructive, murderous, and deceitful behavior. Without an ideology, it is very difficult to maintain that behavior. It just falls apart. Now, there is another factor in the operations of evil in the human animal which needs to be taken into account. And this is extremely arcane, but I'm just going to mention it. It's been on my mind a great deal lately. It has to do with the relation between ideology and neurochemistry. So there is an ideology that legitimates and justifies violence and murderous, deceitful behavior by human beings. And that ideology has been enshrined in largely and almost uniquely in the so-called Jewish or Hebraic religion from its get-go. But it was formulated in four different stages, which I have called Jewish Ethics 1.0, 2.0, and so forth. 2.0 was the Babylonian Talmud. And so if you go and read certain passages in the Babylonian Talmud, you see that there was a religious ideology of hatred, destruction, and deceit hinging on a master race concept. And that this hideous construction of the human mind was necessary in order for certain types of pathological behavior to be maintained. We are now at the end game of that pathology that began or was initially formulated into an ideology in the Abrahamic age, around 1800 BC, when the pointer of the spring equinox, which marks out the different ages of the Kalpa, transited from the constellation of the bull into the constellation of the ram. And that was when the Aryan age or Abrahamic age of this Kalpa began. And that ended around 120 BCE when the vernal point transited from the ram into the fishes. So this ideology has been developing as a rampant virus for over 2,000 years, over 3,000 years actually. And you know that I've described that development in Nod and His Image. Where then does the neurochemistry fit in? And how does it cooperate, as it were, with this ideology, which is the greatest threat to human survival on this planet, by the way? Well, it cooperates in a very pernicious manner. We have now reached humanity, the human species has now reached the point where some members of this species must confront those members who are terminally infected by that religious ideology. They must confront them in real life and in personal, interpersonal, and social reality. And what you find now, if you observe those who are so infected, is that the infection when it reaches the stage where it becomes most viral and most virulent, is supported by the excitation of definite neurochemical processes. Primarily, I mean, I'm taking a wild guess at this. You know, there are like, what, more than 20 known neurotransmitters, including the most famous being serotonin. There's dopamine. There's many others. And no one really knows the exact correlations between these neurotransmitters and behavior. It's a deep and tricky subject, and you could easily get lost in it. But let me take a wild guess and say that it's the production of adrenocortisone that is raised. Let me rephrase it. The enactment of this murderous ideology of divine retribution, which is twinned to the master race concept, the enactment of that hideous behavior raises and reinforces the production of adrenocortisone in the brain. And I think that if any neurochemical can be defined as the medium of violence, brutal, murderous, inhumane violence, as contrasted to humane violence in self-defense, for instance, if any chemical can be identified, I would say that the primary chemical in that diabolical mix is adrenocortisone. That is what psychopaths feed on. Now, the problem of psychopaths is a deep one, as we know. It's an adjunct to this experiment, the study of psychopathic behavior. It's also a basic tool of survival and self-defense in the world today. There are many things that could be said, many things I have said about psychopaths and what I would say now that I haven't said before, here I go again, is that you can put psychopaths in two categories. Those who are actually using that ideology or some disguised form of that ideology to carry out their insane and murderous designs, and those psychopaths who are more or less freelance, not necessarily using that ideology, but feeding off the same type of neurochemical derangement. And I consider that the lesser class of psychopaths, the second class, would include people like serial killers who just get a neurochemical thrill out of stalking and murdering people, are easier to handle than the first class, who find themselves in positions of power and influence in society. From those positions, they can orchestrate their evil designs and commit violence by proxy. And in my opinion, those who perform violence by proxy, such as the heads of state and federal organizations and all types of authorities of that kind, are in a way more dangerous than the lone freelance serial killer that at least will confront you face to face. So, see if I can focus what I've said. I only've got about 10 minutes left to even focus it more clearly. The objective of this experiment right now, not to speak of the ultimate result, the objective is to find your engagement with the power of divine imagination. And one of the consequences of that, when you do that, will be that you have an ability to face evil in human behavior, evil on this planet, and there's a fair dose of it, in a way that you cannot do otherwise. You cannot do it. Why cannot Let's assume, and it's often said this, the vast majority of human beings are peaceful. They just want to get along and survive. How can a small number of psychopaths who are ideologically driven by this insanity complex that goes back to the Zadokim, why are they able to command such power over the rest of humanity, or to exert such power, I should say? Command is not the word. Syntax glitch there. Remember, they don't command the power that they exert. So how are they able to exert such power even though they are only living from the illusion of power? It's because of the default of the rest of the human animals who are not, what can I say, embedded in the sacred power of the earth itself that alone is the bastion against this eruption of evil. So evil is not a production of any way or a byproduct of that sacred power. It is not a test. Evil is not a test, but it does operate like a test in a way. I've spoken of this before. When you face it, you're tested, but it's not a test that the cosmos has intentionally imposed upon the human race. Lately, I've been rereading over and over again a great passage in Goethe's Faust, and you'll find this in part one and in the scene of a conversation between Faust and Mephistopheles in Faust's study, where Faust says to Mephistopheles, this, by the way, is the Philip Wayne translation, which is available in two volumes from Penguin Books. Very good translation, I think. Faust says, "The nature of you doubtful gentlemen, nomenclature may help to recognize, as may be seen specifically when we say destroyer, prince of flies, or lies. Who are you then?" And Mephistopheles replies, "Part of a power that would alone work evil, but engenders good. Part of a power that would alone work evil, but engenders good." Now that power that would alone work evil is what? It's all the evil that you see being done in the world, from the highest levels of financial and governmental authority all the way down the line. And if that power were left alone, it would work evil to such an extent that life in human terms would become impossible. How can it work on its own? It can only work on its own if those human beings who are not engaged in those acts of evil confront it, and by confronting it realize the power of goodness. The power of goodness comes from the sacred dreaming force. There is only goodness in the sacred dreaming force. There is no polarity of good and evil in the sacred dreaming power of the goddess. It's beyond good and evil. There is no satanic or evil principle in the cosmos at large. The founding principle of the cosmos is love, expressed through the generosity of divine beings. And so, our objective now is twofold: to connect with that sacred power, and in doing so, to connect with that within the human animal, within each one of us, that can really make a difference in the struggle taking place on this planet, which is a material and psychological war. With with a small number of human animals infected like rabid dogs and acting out of fear and paranoia and biophobia against the divine experiment. You could say that the result of the GNE is simply a state of knowledge, a state of knowing, but it's not going to be intellectual knowing, I can guarantee you that. Not only intellectual knowing, rather a deep emotional and intuitive bodily, cellular, somatic certainty that you know the original terms of this experiment and how to achieve them. This is the result. You would know that at the end of this experiment. You would know the original terms of the divine experiment with Anthropos 10, as Sophia herself conceived it in the Pleroma, before Anthropos 10 was seated in the myriad worlds, and before the earth itself arose. Now, this is the ultimate goal. This is the ultimate objective. And the current period of time directly ahead of us, with the apogee stall in the eye of the bull and Jupiter defining the focal point for experiments with Channel 16, is entirely dedicated to deepening your engagement with that animating power. Remember that, how does an aeon, I asked the question, how does an aeon define life? Well, it's the electrified animation of colloids. And this animation of colloids is imminently and perpetually sustained by the dreaming power of the goddess. So, that's the source of your life. And living from the source of your life and the source of all life is the highest religious experience possible to the human animal. It's also, I must say, the highest erotic and aesthetic experience accessible to the human animal. And that, reaching that experience, reaching that apotheosis, as I said in the language for the Channel 16 experiments, the Channel 16 telepathy, crescendo, reaching that crescendo is the goal of this experiment. And each member of the crew and myself reach it in our own way. But the beauty of this experiment is we all reach it in the same narrative framework using the same tools and exercises, and we all reach it in the same timing. Now, the purpose of our tests with Channel 16 throughout the winter and into the first 2 months of next year is to coordinate ourselves in that timing and to align ourselves and synchronize ourselves telepathically. I am convinced that at the conclusion of our experiments with Channel 16, the amplification of telepathic powers among those in this experiment will be staggering and also verifiable and voracious. So that is something to look forward to. That is an exciting goal. Practice with Channel 16, situated within the larger goal, which is integration into the dreaming power of the earth. Now, I'll follow this briefing with another one, looking forward to the next test with Channel 16, which would be test 2. I can tell you now that the next occultation of Jupiter by the moon, which is not visible except in South Africa and some part of the southern Pacific. The next time that the moon passes in front of the planet Jupiter is 1 hour universal time on Friday, November 2nd. So check the internet to find out when you reach that universal time relative to whatever time zone you're in. I'll go more into this second test of Channel 16 in the next briefing. I'd also like to point out that due to that fantastic tango dance between Jupiter and the lunar apogee at the eye of the bull, the apogee moments occur very closely timed and synchronized with the Channel 16 moments. And so the next moment of the lunar apogee reaching 10 degrees of Gemini, its point most distant from the Earth, is on Thursday, November 1st, followed very quickly in the first hour of Friday, November 2nd, by the occultation of Jupiter. I'll wind it up here simply because it's 1 hour and 6 minutes, and my usual limit is around here, and I'll leave it to you to determine if I have achieved the goals that I set out for myself at the beginning of this talk. That's it for now. Thanks to all, and safe and happy sailing to all.